From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, February 16th, 2017. And on this day, the fight in the Maine legislature over making citizen initiatives more difficult. And we'll continue our series on aging in Maine with a look at working late in life. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
A federal judge in Bangor has thrown out a lawsuit claiming state and federal wildlife officials were failing to protect the threatened Canada lynx as required by the Endangered Species Act. Fred Bever has details.
Canada lynx are abundant north of the border, but fewer than 1,000 are estimated to survive in Maine. Over the last several years, state and federal wildlife regulators have set and adjusted new rules that permit a limited number of lynx to be accidentally killed or injured in traps that are set for other animals, such as fox or bobcats. It's called an incidental take, but animal rights groups charge the regulators ignored scientific evidence from their own biologists that Maine's lynx population would be imperiled. On Wednesday, U.S. District Court Judge John Levy ruled that the regulators' decision was sound.
I think the courts are right on this one, and the precedent's going to be important going forward.
David Trahan is executive director of the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine.
The ESA is an important, protection for wildlife. But when it's used as a bludgeoning tool for political purposes, then it undermines the entire program.
Animal rights groups agree that the ruling could be precedent-setting, encouraging what they consider lax trapping rules in other states. Daryl DeJoy of the Wildlife Alliance of Maine says that as written, the rules could encourage trappers to conceal an inadvertent trapping of a lynx by shooting the animal and depositing the carcass elsewhere so it won't be counted toward that limit on incidental takes.
Or, as they like to refer to it, shoot, shovel, and shut up. That could just be declared an illegal shooting of a lynx.
DeJoy says the rule's opponents have yet to decide whether to appeal. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
There is a partisan fight looming in the legislature over changes that could make it harder for groups to use Maine's citizen initiative process to pass new laws. At the same time, bipartisan support is emerging to crack down on aggressive tactics used to get on the ballot. As Steve Missler reports, lawmakers weighing new reforms must strike a tricky balance between policing fraud and protecting political speech.
Former Republican State Senator David Trahan has been involved in nearly a dozen ballot initiatives, and Trahan supports the citizen initiative process. But he says,
it's like the Wild West. You guys need to get this under control.
Trahan's talking specifically about paid circulators, the hired guns used to gather signatures needed to put a proposal on the ballot. He was testifying Wednesday in support of a bill that would change the Maine Constitution and prohibit the practice. Paid circulators earn between $3 and $10 per signature, sometimes more depending on the campaign. And it's become a bit of an underground industry in the 26 states that allow citizen-initiated laws. There are Facebook forums in which circulators from across the country talk openly about compensation, benefits, even flight and hotel suggestions. But Trahan and others believe the financial incentive to collect signatures has created an atmosphere ripe for fraud and mayhem in the public squares and Walmart parking lots where the circulators go to solicit.
I've seen fist fights, people fighting over petitions, paid circulators. I've seen them break into each other's cars and steal petitions. I've seen every possible thing you can imagine going on.
Trahan is not alone in this assessment. Lawmakers, campaign workers, and observers have routinely complained about fraud and aggressive tactics by paid signature gatherers. The issue rose to prominence last year when the sister of a controversial gambling impresario launched an unorthodox campaign to install a casino in southern Maine. It was a $2.5 million effort that drew complaints of aggressive tactics from the public and claims by some out-of-state circulators that they were stiffed by the campaign. The campaign's bid last year was disqualified by state election officials for a host of irregularities discovered in the petitions collected, but it has since spent another $1 million and has qualified for this November's ballot. There's bipartisan support for a crackdown and to ban paid circulators altogether. There's just one problem, the First Amendment. It protects free speech and political speech. And nearly 20 years ago, a Maine district court ruled that political speech allows campaigns to pay people to circulate petitions. In doing so, it struck down a 1993 law that prohibited the practice.
I'm very familiar with this. I was a witness for the state and got grilled by the district court judge.
Julie Flynn is the Deputy Secretary of State. She attempted to defend the 1993 law in court, but she says the court wasn't convinced that fraud was a problem in Maine's citizen initiative process, nor did it buy the argument that fraud is more pervasive in campaigns that use paid circulators. At Wednesday's hearing, Flynn told lawmakers that she believes that it can be.
Intuitively, I agree with you. I believe it. I believe that it is more incentive, but we have a problem with demonstrating it to the court.
And so the tension continues, says the Democratic co-chairman of the Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee.
That's what we've always struggled with the citizen initiative, is that, you know, you want to put measures in place to protect it, but you can't do anything that would impinge on anybody's First Amendment rights.
Representative Louis Lucchini says he and GOP co-chairman Senator Garrett Mason are discussing the creation of a work group to prevent fraud and reform the process. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Reports of large-scale nationwide raids are stoking fears in New England immigrants' communities. This comes in the wake of President Trump's recent executive order broadening removal priorities for Immigrant and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agents. Shannon Dooling has this report from Boston.
Immigrants, both those with legal status and those living here illegally, are questioning exactly who is vulnerable for deportation. With his executive order on January 25th, President Trump expanded the priorities of immigration officials in terms of who to focus on for removal. Executive Director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, Ava Malona, says that's made it difficult to know for certain what to expect from local ICE agents.
The office here is not conducting any large-scale raids as far as we know. However, because of the change in priorities, they're out more on the street. So that's what we're hearing from people, that, you know, the visibility, it's really higher.
New England ICE officials say in an email that ICE is not conducting the kinds of operations here that were recently seen in other parts of the country. But in a statement, ICE officials went on to say that, quote, every day, as part of routine operations, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement fugitive operations teams target and arrest criminal aliens and other individuals who are in violation of our nation's immigration laws. The priorities for deportation were expanded to include people with final removal orders and serious criminal convictions, as well as those charged but not yet convicted of a crime. Malona, the immigration advocate, says the uncertainty around the implementation of the executive order can lead immigrants living here illegally to seek legal advice from unqualified people.
People being taken advantage of, money schemes, wrong information, filing the wrong paperwork, and this has happened before to many families.
Malona discourages people from going to notary publics, but instead suggests seeking help from qualified immigration lawyers. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Shannon Dooling in Boston.
And finally today, more and more people are working later in life. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has found Americans age 65 and over have shown the most growth in employment in recent years. That's a trend that's expected to continue. At age 93, Stu Russell still holds down a job at the flagship L.L. Bean store in Freeport. Patty White brings us part four of our series on aging in this life.
There's a story Stu Russell likes to tell. One day while he was working at L.L. Bean, a lost and irritated customer asked him, "How do you get out of here?"
And I said, "Ma'am, I don't know. I had black hair when I came in, you know."
It was 25 years ago when Russell started working here, and now his hair is white. He wears the trademark green L.L. Bean shirt and khaki pants, and he's equipped with a shopping cart, which he leans on to help move himself and other items around the store as a floor stalker.
It's a good job for a guy like me. I can't see very well. I can't hear. Can't walk very good. Except this car. If I didn't have this, I'd be bent over. Because I am wearing out. I'm 93 years old.
But Russell travels at a decent clip as he pushes his cart to the cash registers, where he stocks hot sellers like L.L. Bean Boot keychains and blueberry jams and candies.
All the impulse items, you know, those small items that people pick up. Just walk by and they didn't know they wanted it.
He works from 4 in the morning till noon 4 days a week, though he likes to say he'd rather work 8 days a week. Russell says his commitment to work can be traced back to when he was 12, living in California. That's when his dad died.
when he died, we moved up to where my mother's dad and mother lived, and my grandpa got me a job working in a shoe repair shop.
Russell worked there all through high school. Then he joined the Navy.
I gave all my money to my mother. Even when I was in the Navy, I sent it home. She still had five kids there.
After 8 years in the Navy, Russell's career took some turns. He worked in coffee roasting and auto sales. He started a bank. Next, he made a living buying and selling businesses. He retired briefly in his 60s.
Well, I retired the year my wife died. I told her I was going to retire, and she died, and I figured, gee, I don't want anybody else to die.
He lived in Michigan at the time. A couple years into retirement, Russell visited his son in Maine for the summer.
And one day, he said, Dad, all you do is sit and read books and drink my beer. Go get a job.
So he did, as a temp worker at L.L. Bean. He's been in Maine and at L.L. Bean ever since.
Everybody asked me, what was the best job you ever had? And I said, the one I got right now. And if it had been another one, I'd have said the same thing. I just enjoy what I'm doing.
There are some perks particular to this job. While he lives just down the street and walks to nearby restaurants and a grocery store, the commute to work is a bit too far. But Russell can usually find a ride.
These people here, Beans, they treat me, you can't believe how everybody takes care of me. I got one young girl that takes me back and forth to work, takes me anywhere I want to go.
His colleagues get him to work, and work, says Russell, keeps him going. It's become his mantra.
Do something. Just don't sit. Because I'm just telling you, you're going to die.
That's why, at age 93, Russell isn't contemplating retiring anytime soon, or at all.
God, that would kill me. I mean, it does now. About 2 days off, and I'm about ready to walk the plank.
You'll find him instead walking the floors of L.L. Bean, making sure the shelves are full. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And that's This Day in Maine, Thursday, February 16th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.